IVM
Public policy affects every aspect of your life, from the roads near your home and the lakes in your city, to education and health, to international trade and foreign policy. If you want to understand this interplay of politics, economics, polity and governance, Takshashila Institution's public policy courses are made just for you. The 12-week graduate certificate program gives you a window into the basics of public policy. You can choose to explore the areas of defense and foreign affairs, tech and policy, or advanced public policy. The course is completely online and is conducted on weekends, making it a perfect fit for working professionals. The applications for the May 2024 cohort are now open. Visit school.takshashila.org.in. For more information, visit www.school.takshashila.org.in or click the link in the show notes.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy, Takshashila Institution's flagship daily public policy podcast. I'm Amit Kumar, a research analyst with the Takshashila's Indo-Pacific Studies program and your host for the day. And I'm joined by a very special guest today, Dr. Michael Pettis, an expert on Chinese economy and a professor of finance at Peking University's Wanghua School of Management. He's also a senior fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome, Dr. Pettis.
Thank you very much.
So I think by now our listeners would now have an idea that the topic that we are going to be exploring today would be issues in and around Chinese economy. And while I have Dr. Pettis here, I hope to extract the maximum from him and make the most of his presence today. So Dr. Pettis, let me begin with this. So there are visible and concrete signs of Chinese economic slowdown. The economy has been facing several headwinds and continues to do so. Last year, the economy only grew by 5.2%, and the GDP target for this year, the year of 2024, was also set around 5% in the two sessions. This, in part, I think is also reflective of the fact that even the leadership appreciates the current situation that China is right now. And there are several other headwinds and underlying problems that is staring at Chinese economy, and I would like you to talk about it. But while you do that, my first question is 5% the new normal that the Chinese are looking at, or is there an aspiration to go back to the growth rates of yesteryears, say 7 to 10%? Is this an intermediate phase where they are trying a few things around before getting back to the higher growth rates?
I think it will be impossible to go back to the higher growth rates. In fact, I don't think that on a comparable basis, they have been growing at 5%. I think they've been growing much less than that. It's not because they're lying. It's because there's a problem in the way the GDP statistics are accounted. So as you know, the GDP accounting was more or less invented in the 1930s and 1940s by British and American economists who were trying to measure something very specific about the American and British economies during the Great Depression and during the Second World War. So it's not really a measure of all of the goods and services produced in an economy. It's a measure of certain types of economic activity. One of the problems with GDP is that it can't tell the difference between productive economic activity and non-productive economic activity. So if you build the bridge over a river in the middle of a large city, that bridge creates GDP activity and it adds value to the underlying economy. If you build a similar bridge in the middle of the desert, that bridge doesn't add value to the economy, but it contributes to GDP in the same way while you're building it. There is a Hungarian economist by the name of Janos Kornai who wrote about this. He argued that in the typical capitalist system, you have this problem, but it's resolved through the process of bankruptcy. And that is, if you build enough useless bridges, you will contribute to GDP until you go bankrupt. And then when you go bankrupt, all of that contribution will be written down. So there's a mechanism that ensures that GDP has a meaning. But Kornay argued that, he was a Hungarian economist. He grew up behind the Iron Curtain. He argued that the problem in the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact nations was there wasn't this disciplinary mechanism. The economy didn't operate under hard budget constraints, which means that once you run out of money, you go bankrupt, but rather under soft budget constraints, which meant that if you were politically important, you got unlimited funding. So you could go for years or even decades without facing the problem of bankruptcy. The problem there is that GDP is now counting both productive and non-productive activity. So imagine if you had two Chinas that were identical. In one China, you calculate GDP the way we do in China. And in the other China, whenever there's non-productive activity, it gets written down after a year or 2 years or whatever. Those two Chinas, remember, we're defining as identical. And yet the first China will show a much higher GDP growth rate than the second China. And that's the problem. The GDP growth rate in China is not really comparable to GDP growth in India or in the US or in Germany or in Brazil, because there isn't that hard budget constraint. Much of the economy and an increasing share of the economy occurs under soft budget constraints. And that has to continue as long as the government set GDP growth targets that exceed the real growth rate of the underlying economy. So that's the problem China faces. You can achieve any growth rate you like if you have unlimited debt capacity. But last year was sort of formal recognition of the debt problem in China. Debt levels are so high that many provincial governments simply can no longer continue doing the sort of things that they were doing in order to achieve very high GDP growth targets. So the big question we have in China is, will the central government replace the local governments in terms of borrowing in order to continue meeting high GDP growth targets? If it does, we could probably do this for another 3 or 4 years before we run into constraints. If they don't, then it's going to be very hard even to achieve the 5% growth target this year.
So, Dr. Pettis, you say that the returning back to high growth rates is something which we'll not see. And maybe below 5% is what we'll likely see in the coming years. And the government is also faced with the same question. And in the past 2-3 years, we have seen that domestic consumption has received a lot of attention from the leadership over the past few years. And the leadership seems committed to boosting domestic consumption and wanted to play an even bigger role in fueling its economy for now. So in percentage terms, it's only about 37%. It contributes only 37% to China's GDP, quite low if you compare it to other developing and emerging countries where the contribution is in excess of 50 or 60%. And so maybe the leadership sees an opportunity in expanding consumption. But what one must also recognize that low consumption in China is also a function of its deliberate financial repression, a cost it had to pay to be a leading exporting country. But now there's a focus on boosting domestic consumption. So what seems to be the plan here? When the leadership says boosting consumption and making it a new driver, does it mean boosting consumption that is at par with the other emerging and developing and or developed countries? Also, the other question that I want to ask you is, do you see an underlying contradiction here in trying to boost domestic consumption as well as expanding exports? I mean, there are some encouraging signs on the exports front for China in the last 1 year or so. So the second question is essentially is high consumption and high exports difficult balance to achieve?
Yeah, in fact, they're opposites. If you look at countries that run trade surpluses, they're all countries in which manufacturing is a very high share of GDP. Savings is a very high share of GDP, which is the same thing as saying consumption is a low share of GDP. And the reason these countries are successful exporters is not because they're particularly efficient at manufacturing. The reason is because there are a whole series of transfers, direct and indirect, from the household sector to subsidize manufacturing. You mentioned financial repression. For many years, interest rates in China were extremely low. And low interest rates are a transfer. They're a transfer from net savers, who are the household sector, to net borrowers, who in China are mostly manufacturers, state-owned enterprises, and local governments. China also has an undervalued exchange rate, which is also a net transfer. It's a transfer from net importers, and all households are net importers, to net exporters, which is the manufacturing sector. In addition, there are a whole series of restrictions on workers, which make it very hard for them to raise wages in line with increases in productivity.
My second question was, leading from what you explained, was given what you have said, is how realistic is this assumption that, or this objective of getting, of boosting the consumption, in fact? And will the conditioning of the Chinese consumers from this sort of financial repression that has happened over the years and decades, can it prove too resistant to change and enable a rise in consumption? Do you see behavior will also come into play when the Chinese leadership says that consumption is something that we want to boost? Given these two factors, do you think behavior will also play a role?
Behavioral issues are mostly irrelevant here. The problem in China, and the problem in all countries with weak domestic demand, is that households retain a very low share of what they produce. So, for example, in the US, households retain roughly 80% of GDP. In China, they retain roughly 60% of GDP. So it's not surprising that consumption is much lower in China than it is in the United States. So if you want to solve the problem, and they've been talking about this problem since 2007. In 2007, household consumption was 37% of GDP. Today, 17 years later, it is 38% of GDP. So clearly, they haven't really resolved this problem. And the reason it's so hard to resolve is that the way you resolve it is you have to increase the household share of GDP. But unfortunately, increasing the household share means reducing somebody else's share. And that's the difficult part. Ultimately, they shouldn't reduce the business share because that'll undermine their competitiveness. So they must reduce the government share. And in China, there are two governments. There is the central government, Beijing, and then there are the local governments. And so what we're seeing in China, I think, is a very vigorous debate, to put it mildly, over who's going to pay for the costs of this adjustment. But this is a very difficult problem to resolve. Countries often take years or even decades to resolve it.
Right. Yes, domestic consumption seems to be a tricky problem for the Chinese. Next, I want to pick you up on another issue of significance is that of private sector sentiment. So after the ripples that the leadership created by cracking down on several edtech, real estate, and even Alibaba fintech companies, we also saw last year that there was a series of crackdown on consultancy firms and on American firms such as Micron, Bain & Co. and several others. Even the domestic consultancies were not spared either, right? This has dented private sector confidence substantially and compounded the problem it was already facing on account of weak demand and the deepening geopolitical rivalry between the US and China. And according to the recent AmCham report, geopolitics and regulatory environment figure as the top two concerns for companies which have operations in China. And the leadership over the past one year has now been trying to woo in private sector. We saw some relaxation regulatory requirements. Xi Jinping, when he was on his way to San Francisco, he met several business leaders. Some top big tech leaders from America and other countries were in China both last year and this year. And then at the China Development Forum, also China seemed to assuage these concerns which have been there on these fronts. So my question to you is, how serious is the government on restoring the private sector sentiment? Essentially, how ready is the government to loosen up these regulatory requirements? And two, what do you make of the private sector sentiment from where you're sitting?
Well, I think the private sector, and particularly the foreign private sector, is very worried, very nervous for all the reasons that you mentioned. But I'm not sure that that's the big problem in the Chinese economy. Foreign companies were very important in the 1990s and 2000s because of technology transfers. Today, there really isn't much in the way of technology transfer. Either China has the technology or the technology that it needs will no longer be transferred by foreign companies. So what's the role of foreign investment in China? I think it's really nominal. I don't think it matters that much. You have to remember that the huge success of the private sector that everyone talks about was really not the success of the private sector. There was the success of industrial policies that directed huge amounts of resources to supporting the private sector. And now, because a lot of the investment that China needed for decades has already been resolved, we're seeing a shifting, as I said in answer to my first question, we're seeing a shifting in the role of the hard budget constrained part of the economy. It's becoming less and less important, and that includes, of course, the private sector, while the soft budget constrained part of the economy, the part that doesn't go bankrupt, that gets unlimited funding, is getting larger and larger. What China really needs to resolve is the second part. So I think foreign firms, although, you know, local governments want to attract them for prestige reasons and for domestic growth reasons, I don't think they matter that much to the Chinese economy. I think, you know, foreigners like to think that they matter, but they don't matter that much.
Yeah, and do domestic private investors have a concern in terms of doing business? Are they also very as much as the foreign businesses in China?
Yeah, many of them are worried, but the reason they're worried is not because of the change in rules. The reason they're worried is because they're being encouraged to increase capacity, but demand remains very, very weak. At the end of the day, if you have a business, there's no point producing stuff if no one's going to buy it. And if no one is buying what you're producing and there's pressure from the government to increase your production, then what you really rely on is an increase in exports. And so if you talk to local businessmen in China, most of them will tell you that the problem is the lack of demand. So we go right back to the consumption problem. It's the heart of all of China's problems.
Certainly. Maybe the government has some plans to come up with it. A related issue in this regard is also what the government has been talking about, the productive forces or the new quality productive forces, with technology and innovation at the center and the talk about technology and innovation-led economy, right, which Xi Jinping has reiterated on many instances. And something that has been in the circulation for more than a year now and has got good amount of attention also during the two sessions and founder mentioned the annual work report as well. So my question to you is, what are your thoughts on this approach of Chinese leadership and how equipped is China to make this transformation? Can it be a substitute for all drivers of China's economy, as the leadership has been saying? Do you find anything questionable in the merit of the argument? Can it be a substitute for all drivers of China's economy?
No, and we've seen this movie many, many times before. When the Soviet economy ran into trouble in the 1960s, there was a hope that investment in technology, breakthroughs in technology, would pull it out of its problems. Brazil in the late 1970s thought more investment in technology and manufacturing will solve our overinvestment problem. Japan in the late 1980s, it's a common response. But the problem is that even in the United States, which is considered the economy most dependent on high technology, high tech represents 9% of the economy at most. In China, it's much less than that. Most of the economy is in the property sector, is in building infrastructure, is in young men delivering food on bicycles. That's really what we need to focus on. And so what I'm afraid of is that Beijing is making a mistake that many other governments have made, And that is by assuming that if only we spend enough on technology and make some miraculous breakthrough, that will solve the imbalance problems we have domestically. They've been talking about this for years. They have certainly made important technological breakthroughs, but there are two really big questions about those breakthroughs. The first is, are they commercially sustainable, or are they just excessive spending on technology without a clear economic benefit from doing so? And then secondly, the question is, even if they are commercially sustainable, are they important enough to drive out the imbalance problems in China? Remember, most technologically successful economies have been demand-driven. Economies that have tried to be technologically successful on the supply side have found it much more difficult. And in China, we come back once again to the same old problem, and that is that there's very little demand for all of this.
Right. And also the fact that U.S.-China tech war, which is at the center of the trade war, will play its part. I mean, if we're going to see two different technology ecosystems, wherein one is led by the U.S. and its allies and its partners, where China is an excluded member and China is not allowed in that ecosystem, there is a possibility that China will end up in a situation where it has to develop every, let alone breakthroughs, but even the process technologies all it by itself. And that will have a cost. The advantage that the U.S. and its allies and partners would have is that of the burden sharing, something that China might not have. And that will make the cost for those breakthrough technologies or high-tech core technologies even more costlier for China. Would that be right assumption?
Yes. Honestly, Amit, I'm not enough of a technology expert to tell you if that creates a real problem if we have two different standards. A lot of people say it will, and I'm willing to believe that it will, but I don't have a lot to add to that.
Lastly, Dr. Pettis, I think a couple of days before, Nicholas Lardy came out with his article for Foreign Affairs, wherein he says that deflation and depreciation in China's economy are transitory, which I agree with, right, largely. But he also goes on to say and claim that in a decade's time, China will certainly overtake American economy. And I know many people have been taking bets whether the Chinese economy will find eventually take over the American economy and become the largest economy of the world. And others have taken the side that no, it might never be the case. Clearly, Nicholas Lardy has taken a side. What do you make of this argument, and how do you see this rivalry playing out?
I don't take it very seriously. I've never really believed that it would become the world's largest economy. But I would hasten to add that it doesn't really matter. What really matters is GDP per capita, how wealthy individuals are. But I don't think it'll become the world's largest economy for the same reason that we saw in the Soviet Union in the 1960s or in Japan in the 1980s. We forget, but in the 60s, pretty much everyone knew that the Soviet Union would overtake the U.S. sometime in the 1980s. Paul Samuelson even put that in his textbook. And in the 1980s, it was very clear that in the 21st century, Japan would overtake the U.S. as the world's largest economy. And it never happened. And it never happened for the same reason. In both cases, those economies were growing very, very quickly on an investment-driven model. And that investment-driven model was very successful when those countries were hugely underinvested. Japan, after World War II, had pretty much all of its infrastructure and manufacturing capacity destroyed. So it needed to rebuild everything. The problem is that once you have enough investment, or you've reached the level of investment that you can productively absorb, that growth model has always delivered continued rapid growth, but very unhealthy growth driven by surges in debt, and then a very difficult adjustment. The main difference between China today and Japan in the 80s and the Soviet Union in the 60s is that the imbalances in China are much greater than we saw in Japan, for example. So I think that's very unlikely. In Nick Lardy's piece, he also argued that, yes, China is facing trouble, but it faced big troubles in the 1980s and it managed to get through them. So we should assume it'll get through them again. But that's not a very good argument, right? Because you could have argued in the 1980s that, yes, Japan is facing trouble, but it faced huge, much bigger problems after World War II, and it got through them. So you can make the same argument about the Soviet Union, the same argument about Brazil in the late 1970s. A model that succeeds, a political and economic model that succeeds under one set of conditions, isn't necessarily a very robust model that can succeed under very different conditions. So a model that solves your problem when your problem is that you are seriously underinvested isn't a model that can solve your problem when your problem is that you are hugely overinvested. So, you know, we'll see. There's no way to know who's right or who's wrong here, except by waiting. And I suspect that a decade from now, it will be very hard to find anyone who admits to believing that they thought that China would be the world's largest economy, you know, by 2030. Again, I use the example of Japan because, you know, by 2000, it seemed like nobody in the world ever thought Japan would be the world's largest economy. But I can promise you, in the late 1980s, if you didn't believe that, you were treated as a simpleton. It was so obviously true. We have a very poor track record of making these kinds of predictions. I suspect this is one more case, but we'll see. We'll wait and see.
Certainly, we'll have to wait and see if that ever happens. Another question that he raises in his article, Nicholas Lardy, is that private investment in China's economy has actually witnessed a growth if you leave out real estate, which again is true. But if one looks at the figures, one notices that real estate has been a major chunk of its overall private investment. And so if you take real estate out, although there have been certain measures the government has rolled out to, again, encourage the development of the sector. But if you leave that out, do you think there is any other avenue that could be explored that could actually go on to replace real estate's position within the overall private investment and give the kind of growth that real estate offered to Chinese economy? Is there an alternative?
No, they're trying to do that with this huge shift into manufacturing. But China already accounts, China is 17% of global GDP, but it accounts for 31% of global manufacturing. And the growth model requires that Chinese share of global manufacturing rise twice as quickly as Chinese share of global GDP, and 3 to 4 times as quickly as Chinese share of global consumption, which can only work if the rest of the world agrees to accommodate it. So if the US, Europe, India, Japan agree, we will reduce our manufacturing sector and increase our consumption in order to help you, China, achieve your growth goals, then it could work. But I don't need to tell you, neither Japan nor India nor the United States nor Europe is eager to see a continued erosion of its manufacturing sectors. So that's going to be very, very hard to pull off. You know, the other point that I would make is really, this is a very American thing, a belief that everything good comes from the private sector and everything bad comes from the public sector. But we should be very clear, the great growth in China wasn't delivered by the private sector. It was delivered by the private sector with massive support from the government in the form of low wages, of preventing wages from growing as quickly as productivity, in the form of almost free capital. For a big part of this century, companies were able to borrow at negative real interest rates, thanks to the government, with the support of massive expenditures in infrastructure, which are economically loss-making for the country, but very good if you own a business because you take advantage of this spectacular infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. So this argument that Chinese growth is slowed because the private sector has contracted and it will grow as the private sector expands gets the causality backwards. It's not the private sector that's driving growth, and it's not the contraction in the private sector that explains the slowdown in Chinese growth in the last couple of years. It's the other way around. As growth slowed down, more and more of the economy had to occur under soft budget constraints. So that reduced the role of the private sector. The only way you can get the private sector to drive growth is if the government is willing to fund loss-making activities on the part of the private sector. You know, our focus is on the wrong place.
Right. That's quite an interesting revelation, I'm sure, for most of our listeners, and even for me, actually. So, Dr. Peters, one last question, and this is a hypothetical question, and I hope you answer this. If you were an advisor to Xi Jinping, is there anything that can be done to bring Chinese economy back on track? Or is this just too difficult or impossible at this time, wherein the economy is facing so many headwinds that it's almost impossible to get out of this? Is there a way out for China? Something that can do to go back to at least 6-7%, if not 10? Is there a way out for the Chinese leadership?
6-7% is pretty much impossible. 10% will never happen. But there is a way of keeping growth, and I don't think anyone in China expects that. You know, Nick Lardy may say they can do things to bring growth up to 6%, but it's very hard to find. There are one or two economists, but most economists in China are hoping for a way to keep growth between 4-5% for the next few years. And I would say there is a way of doing that. If local governments could be forced to transfer about 1.5% of GDP every year from themselves to the household sector, then in theory, you could get consumption to grow at around 7%. That would allow you to bring investment growth down sharply while still maintaining GDP growth of around 4% or higher. So arithmetically, there is a way to maintain 4% growth, but it requires a very, very difficult political process. It requires that Beijing is able to force local governments to transfer the assets that they own directly or indirectly to the household sector. And it's not just that local governments own these assets as something on the side. The important thing to understand is that the Chinese economy, including local political elites, local business elites, local financial elites, are based on institutions that are themselves based on local government ownership of assets. And so we're talking about a major transformation of local institutions in order to accomplish this. It's not impossible, but it's not easy.
Right. And just a small follow-up. In the beginning, you said GDP per capita is what is important, not the GDP, whole nominal GDP. And if what you answered the just previous question is right, where does that leave China in terms of per capita GDP or per capita income? Is the middle income trap very real for China, very possible? Where does that leave China?
Yeah, I'm uncomfortable with the middle income trap because very often it seems to me that because we don't know why rapidly growing developing countries suddenly stop growing, then we invent this phrase middle income trap and that becomes the explanation. So it's a totally circular argument. But to the extent that the middle income trap has meaning, in which case it affects not just middle income countries, it affects countries like Japan, which is a high income country, I would argue that when growth is generated by transfers from the household sector to subsidize manufacturing and investment, which is what happened in Japan, what happened in China, what happened in a number of other countries, you can generate a lot of growth in the beginning, but at some point you have the demand imbalance problem. And the demand imbalance problem can only be resolved by reversing those transfers. So in the short term, reversing the transfers is really bad for the manufacturing sector, and it could cause negative growth in the economy. You need to do it in the long term, but it's so painful in the short term that you keep postponing it. And that's why you get no growth. If you look at Japan, way back in 1986, the Mayakawa Commission report made very clear what Japan needed to do to rebalance its economy and start growing again. 1986 is what, 37 or 38 years ago. And we're still talking about that. In today's Financial Times, there is an article saying, has Japan finally solved its problem? 38 years later, we're still asking if Japan has solved that problem. If that's the middle income problem or the middle income trap, then I think, yes, China definitely faces it because the manufacturing sector in China is even larger as a share of GDP than it is in Japan. So it's a harder transition to make.
Certainly, it looks like China is in for a continuous trouble, keep coming out Chinese economy, and it seems like there's no way around unless China actually goes on to fix its consumption and domestic consumption, as you pointed out, Dr. Pettis, as we keep circling back to that same problem.
And everyone knows it's the problem. We just don't know how to solve it.
Right. So there'll be some thinking required amongst the top leadership and the economists within the Chinese ecosystem to come up with a solution, which none of us seems to have a clear-cut solution for this. But on that note, Dr. Pettis, this was an honor and a complete pleasure to talk to you about the Chinese economy. And I hope our listeners enjoyed this conversation and had a lot to take away from this conversation. And I hope to host you again sometime soon on any of the developments as and when it comes on the issue of Chinese economy. It was great having you, Dr. Pettis.
Thank you very much, Amit, and I hope we speak again.
Sure. Thank you so much.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.